Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. North Korea's foreign ministry is calling the latest United Nations sanctions an act of war and tantamount to a complete economic blockade. In a statement carried by the North Korean state news agency, the ministry spokesman says that Pyongyang categorically rejects the resolution, which it says is the result of U.S. terror and the success of its nuclear and missile programs. Reuters' John Hyland has more.
The U.S. drafted resolution, supported by longtime Pyongyang allies Russia and China, commits the Security Council to further sanctions if there's another nuclear test or ballistic missile launch. In November, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un declared the nuclear force complete after the test of the isolated nation's largest ever missile, which it said puts all of the United States within range. It denies its nuclear program is in contradiction of international law, but rather a self-defensive deterrence. The latest statement described Washington as getting, quote, more and more frenzied in moves to impose the harshest ever sanctions and pressure on the country.
The United States and other Western countries swiftly condemned a move in Kosovo to scrap a war crimes court, warning that if successful, it would hamper efforts for Euro-Atlantic integration. The United States has been a key ally and financial backer of Kosovo since it broke away from Serbia and then declared independence in the year 2008. Both ambassadors were at Kosovo's parliament building Friday. They and other Western ambassadors met Saturday behind closed doors with the Kosovo prime minister to discuss the issue after 43 lawmakers moved to present a petition by former fighters of the Kosovo Liberation Army. This is VOA News. An official of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, or the FBI, plans to step down after months of criticism in Washington. More from Reuters' Nathan Frandino.
Andrew McCabe's time at the FBI may be coming to an end. The Washington Post reported on Saturday that the FBI deputy director plans to retire next year. The newspaper said the retirement would come as soon as he becomes eligible for his full pension, which would be in early March. The news comes after months of criticism from President Donald Trump, who has publicly questioned why McCabe remains in his position. On Saturday, Trump tweeted that McCabe is racing the clock to retire with full benefits, 90 days to go. An FBI spokeswoman declined to comment. McCabe also faced criticism from congressional Republicans who have accused him of harboring bias against Trump. He's been interviewed by multiple House committees on the 2016 election and whether Trump's campaign colluded with Russia, as well as on the FBI's handling of its probe into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State.
Ukraine's president thanked the United States for its decision to provide lethal weapons to the country, while diplomats in Russia warned the move would only cause more bloodshed. The angry response from Moscow followed the U.S. announcement that it will provide Ukraine with the weapons in an effort to help the country with its fight against Russian-backed separatists in the eastern part of the country. U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis responds to Russian comments about the weapons deal being provocative.
Defensive weapons are not provocative unless you're an aggressor. And clearly, Ukraine is not an aggressor since it's their own territory where the fighting is happening.
And earlier this month, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson warned Russia that the standoff over Ukraine was the single most important obstacle to warmer ties between the two countries. Venezuela's leftist government has begun releasing some political prisoners. It's a rare goodwill gesture to the opposition. And President Nicolas Maduro's government decided to release at least 80 of them who were detained after participating in anti-government demonstrations. Two recent incidents have bolstered the Trump administration's stance against the United States' family-based immigration system, which the president says threatens national security. Tyler Holton, acting press secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, said in a statement that his agency could confirm the suspect involved in a terror attack in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and another suspected person arrested on terror-related money laundering charges were both beneficiaries of extended family chain migration. He said both incidents highlight the Trump administration's concerns with extended family chain migration. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Vice President Boakai said that if he is elected, although he's been in the government for the past 12 years, he will make sure that road construction will be his top priority because he believes that a good road network will lead to economic development.
Incumbent Liberian Vice President Joseph Boakai campaigns ahead of the presidential election runoff.
He deems it necessary that since he owes that tenorship to the people of Sierra Leone, that he needed to go around to bid them farewell, but overwhelmingly to tell them a big thank you for giving him the opportunity to serve for 10 uninterrupted years.
The Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma embarks on a nationwide thank you tour.
The government is maintaining ceasefire because we listen to our partners, we listen to the international community. That's why we don't have any need to go for offensive.
And the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir commits to the full implementation of the latest ceasefire agreement with rebels. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. It is one more day before Liberians cast ballots in their much-delayed presidential runoff election on Tuesday. Liberian football legend George Weah and presidential candidate of the Coalition for Democratic Change, or CDC, is contesting for the top post against incumbent Vice President Joseph Boakai of the ruling Unity Party. Viewer James Batty is in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Good evening, James.
Thank you very much, Peter, and good evening to you and to your listeners.
So let me ask you, James, I understand the vice president from the Unity Party, the ruling party, is having his last campaign, rather, ahead of the election runoff on Tuesday. What can you tell me about this?
Well, that's right. When we last spoke on Saturday, Peter, Vice President Joseph Boakai was campaigning in the countryside, Nimba County, to be specific. We are told by the vice president's campaign officials that he will be returning to the capital city, Monrovia, later today, Sunday. So upon his return, the vice president will begin what they call a caravan tour of the neighborhoods here in Monrovia, meaning going from neighborhood to neighborhood to meet the people. After that, they say the vice president is to address the nation or speak on the national radio and television, probably giving his final word before the election on Tuesday, December 26th. To see why the vice president went to Nimba County, as you know, you probably know, the Nimba County is the second county, the second vote-rich county in the country next to Montserrat County, where the capital city, Monrovia, is. You can see that's why many candidates have been campaigning in that area.
Well, James, what is the mood in the capital, Monrovia, in anticipation of the vice president's final campaign rally today?
Well, I can say the mood here is that the people are in a kind of a festive mood because, first of all, this is the Christmas holiday, and Monday is going to be Christmas. People are festive because of that. So two things are colliding to create the kind of festive atmosphere here in Monrovia. First, everyone is very enthusiastic about who they want to vote for. And next, this is the Christmas holiday. The holiday season is upon the people, just like you have in the United States.
Now, in these final hours of the runoff election campaign, what are these two candidates talking about, soccer legend and Senator George Weah and Vice President Boakai?
Well, as you know, that George Weah is telling the people that he is the candidate of change. And therefore, when he becomes president, he's telling the people that he's going to make sure his government is going to make sure to bring about economic and social development. So if they elect him, that he's telling the people that he's the candidate of change. Vice President Boakai, on the other hand, said that if he is elected,
Although he's been in the government for the past 12 years, he said to the people that he was not president then, but if he's elected, he will make sure that road construction, the building of the road infrastructure in this country, will be his top priority, because he believes that a good road network will lead to economic development.
That was my colleague James Batty reporting from Liberia. He spoke with me from Monrovia. The Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma is embarking on a nationwide thank you tour. The aim, the government says, will enable the president to thank the people of Sierra Leone as his term expires early next year. He is accompanied by Samura Kamara, the presidential candidate for the ruling All People's Congress, or APC, for the March 7 general election. Opponents say the presence of the presidential candidate shows that the so-called thank you tour is a ploy to campaign for the unpopular ruling party candidate before official campaign begins. The opposition parties also called on prospective voters to reject the ruling party and its presidential candidate. For reaction regarding the thank you tour, I reached presidential spokesman Abdoulaye Bereti.
When the president came into governance in 2007, after he served as opposition leader from 2002 until that period, to him he adduced, or rather received, the mandate of the people overwhelmingly. And part of his own democratic credential is to always promote the model of participatory democracy. Therefore, with all the challenges and the successes he has scored in this 10 years he has been president, he deems it necessary that since he owed that tenorship to the people of Sierra Leone, that he needed to go round to bid them farewell, but overwhelmingly to tell them a big thank you for giving him the opportunity to serve for 10 uninterrupted years, and also to give a report card of where he achieved and the challenges that still remain, so that he would be leaving office in a very transparent and also being accountable.
What do you say to critics who are saying that this is just a mere political move to highlight the presidential candidate of the ruling party to make him look good, and that this is all political machinations from the president to try to suppress the opposition?
Well, I think there has been a whole lot of misinformation. The reason being, all the town hall meetings the president has been addressing, he invited local authorities, including paramount chiefs and traditional leaders. Members of the opposition were in attendance. And that's to them, when it comes to the development agenda, and that's what President Koroma is doing currently, has transcended and changed the political narrative. For the president to do that, I think he has been commended across the aisle from various political parties.
Critics of the president are saying that this farewell thank you shouldn't even be, because his stewardship for the last 10 years has been a waste of time, that he has failed to improve the living conditions of the ordinary Sierra Leonean, and that he also failed to recently resolve concerns of teachers and university students who went on strike, and for which for weeks he refused to address those concerns. What is your response to that?
Well, I must say it is the opposite right now from what I'm hearing from you, because so far all the president where he has been, there has been a public endorsement, because he is on history and he is on record. When he addressed the public, he said, you know what, since independence, there has never been a president that brought in electricity supply to this magnitude across the country.
What do you say to those of his critics who are saying that the president has yet to account to the people of Sierra Leone of the Ebola funds, millions of dollars that the international community gave to Sierra Leone, and that even the recent cash and kind gestures given by the international community during the mudslide and the flood, there has not been a proper accountability to the people of Sierra Leone of what all these funds are used for?
When the issue about transparency was touted during the fight against Ebola, President Kuruma authorized a real-time auditing. And some civil society people were found wanted. And they have been taken to the Anti-Corruption Commission. And they have paid. And the ACC issued a public statement to the effect. Somebody failed to deliver some vehicles, ambulances that were procured. The ACC intervened, and the remaining four ambulances were brought back to the country. What we are looking at here is, when you mention about the mudslide, the funds were being managed not by government. We had a fiduciary agent called the BDO, which operates in over 162 countries. They are being paid by the Department for International Development, the DFID of the UK, so that they can manage the resources very, very well. And so far, now that the mudslide response is scaling down, they are preparing their boats to report to the government on how much was expended, how much was received, etc., etc. And suffice it to say, though, that I happen to be the communication pillar lead during the mudslide response. BDO has been issuing out periodic financial statements on monies received, what is in our dollar account, and what is in the Leone account in a very transparent way.
Abdoulaye Berete is the spokesman for the Sierra Leonean President Enes Bai Koroma. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa appointed a recently retired army general and a defense official Saturday as the country's ruling ZANU-PF party's vice presidents. General Constantino Chiwenga, who retired last Sunday, led the military takeover in November that precipitated the resignation of the country's longtime president, Robert Mugabe. Defense Minister Kembo Mohadi is the other person appointed as the ZANU-PF party's vice president. The announcement was made in a statement Saturday by George Charamba, spokesman for President Mnangagwa. For reaction, I read Zimbabwean political analyst Rejoice Ngwenya in the capital, Harare.
Zimbabweans, they have always resigned to the issue that this whole military maneuver would end up with individuals being rewarded for taking a risk. So the excitement really was about the removal of Mugabe and his resignation. Whatever comes now, Zimbabweans are simply saying, look, ZANU-PF, the constitutional right to decide who completes the term before the election, is a lot of apathy and in the dynamics of the state house.
Before President Robert Mugabe was forced out, they said anybody by President Mugabe. Are they now accepting of the new paradigm in Zimbabwe?
Well, you obviously expect a lot of resistance from institutions and individuals that have always said that a constitutional democracy like Zimbabwe does respect civilian authority. But there are those that say, look, there's going to be elections next year, so there's no need to panic.
How do you respond to critics who are saying that there appears to be a militarization of the Zimbabwean government now?
There's never really been a situation in Zimbabwe since 1980 when the military has been totally excluded from institutions. But what is happening now is mostly in terms of its openness. It's more open. The intervention is more open. But, Zimbabwe generally accepts things. I've seen a lot of tweets and a lot of comments on social networks saying, look, if these guys can deliver what Mugabe failed to deliver, jobs, a functional economy, and possibly credible elections, which I really doubt, the Zimbabweans seem to be satisfied with the current so-called militarization status quo.
What do you say to the analysts who are saying the appointment of Chiwenga is further evidence of the level of influence the army is now gaining in Zimbabwe?
I agree with them in total in that there is absolutely no way we are going to get away with this for the time being. I mean, we all accepted that the military played a role, a big role, in displacing the dynastic entity of Robert Mugabe. So there must be some kind of tacit that the military has to be rewarded. Look, they have removed their uniforms, but that does not make them civilians. You can hear some whimpers of resistance, but like I said before, I think the Zimbabweans have resigned I myself am absolutely unhappy, but I'm saying let's wait for elections and we push for electoral reform and we hope that there's not going to be a military intervention again.
Do people see this as a thank you or a reward for playing a key role in forcing President Robert Mugabe to step down?
Absolutely. You know, if those were there the night of the long night, to borrow from literature, there was huge appreciation of the military role. In fact, somebody was saying to me, even if the military, if Chiwenga was on the ballot box for that night, I'm sure Morgan Tsvangirai was going to have a huge running for his money. So really, there is some kind of feeling that it is okay to reward these guys for what they did. But the victory is very temporary because by the time we get to election this year, the Zimbabweans will be itching for a civilian authority.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. The South Sudanese President Salva Kiir is committed to the signed ceasefire agreement with the rebels. Presidential spokesman Atenyuwe Kateni says the president has also ordered the army not to go on the offensive following the agreement. His remarks came after the government and the rebels signed a ceasefire pact Thursday in the latest attempt to end a four-year civil war and allow humanitarian groups access to civilians caught in the conflict. The ceasefire agreement aims to revive a 2015 peace deal that collapsed last year after heavy fighting broke out in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. For more on the commitment of the administration, I reach Atenyuwe Kateni in Juba.
The ceasefire agreement was a document that was pre-prepared, before the parties came to sign on it. Some rebels representatives tried before the signing to argue and put some precondition, but later on the mediators came in and convinced them to allow the cessation of hostilities and humanitarian access agreement to take momentum. The agreement is signed, as the government of South Sudan expressed very serious political will to ensure he returned the country to normalcy so that the polarization of the country can come to an end as this sanction goes and goes and goes without any, substantial evidence against those who are sanctioned. Now, it is incumbent upon rebels, because I have seen some of them actually sign, when in actual fact, most of them do not have any forces in the ground. But let's see if they can actually respect this. And the government of South Sudan has already expressed the political will to cease the hostilities, as we have not been on offensive before the coming of Ambassador Nikki Haley.
Will the government and its troops, or the government forces, hold its side of the agreement not to attack the rebel positions?
Yes, this is what has been happening. It has been the SPLM-IO that alleged, to be under Riek Machar, that has been attacking. Even last Saturday, they attacked Raja and they abducted humanitarian workers. And I've not seen the international community coming to condemn this. There are humanitarian workers that have been, abducted, and their whereabouts is unknown. But the government is maintaining ceasefire because we listen to our partners, we listen to the international community. That's why we don't have any need to go for offensive.
Do you anticipate President Salva Kiir issuing a directive to all soldiers under him not to attack the rebels?
President Salva Kiir is the most genuine actor in this, and he has been issuing such a statement time and again. And then the moment the president issued decree or orders for the army to cease hostilities, the next moment our position are attacked by the rebels, because they are enjoying the fact that the international actors have just demonstrated intentional ignorance by condemning the two parties, or all the parties have done this or they have done that, as if the parties are capable of committing crime simultaneously. And this is what the rebel has been enjoying. Now, if we have signed the cessation of hostilities, the side of President Salva Kiir is the most genuine side, and we will adhere to our signature.
Will the president be committed, and for that matter, the army be committed to this yet another agreement of cessation of hostilities? Because this is not the first time cessation of hostilities agreement have been signed, and repeatedly it's been violated. Although accusations and counter-accusations have been thrown against each other, both from the government and the rebels.
You know, the problem is this, and any reasonable person can understand it. Rebels are scattered, and most of them have no source of even the logistic. So some of them may be tempted to attack in order to get logistic if they get a sub-target. So whenever President Salva Kiir issue an order, the army adhere to the order. But adhering to the order doesn't mean that they can waive the right to self-defense. You know, an army cannot go for an offensive, but when they are attacked, they will return the fire in self-defense. So most of the time that the cessation of hostilities or any ceasefire agreement is violated, it is the rebels' side that start attacking the government soldiers, you know, for different reasons. You know, sometimes they would just found a soft target and they wanted to snatch, you know, some food from it. And that will be a provocation against the army. So if the rebels are actually really under the command of Riek Machar, and that they will adhere to what Dr. Riek Machar will tell them, you know, in order for the signed cessation of hostilities to continue without violation, then that will be a miracle. And I think we have to wait and see if the rebel will take heed to the leadership command, you know, orders.
Attorney Wekateni is the spokesperson for South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from Juba.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on The Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best.
Yes, sir. Two Face, NATO C. Hey.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, hundreds of Nigerian refugees who have fled the Boko Haram insurgency to the Minnawao camp in northern Cameroon now have the potential to become professional models. This after they were trained by the United Nations to be self-reliant and useful to themselves and their communities if they accept to voluntarily return home. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Minnawao, a majority of the carpenters and seamstresses are mothers.
Twenty-nine-year-old Naomi Hammond cuts wood with a handsaw to make a bench for the Minnawao refugee camp school. The refugee, who has been in the camp for 2 years, says in November 2017 she completed a six-month training in carpentry.
She
trained to be a carpenter so that sometimes even he go to Nigeria, he can able to make something like chair or stool like that so that it can help her.
But Naomi's know-how is already useful and helping her to have some income. The mother of two, who had depended solely on her husband before he was killed by Boko Haram in Nigeria and continued depending on humanitarian assistance after fleeing to Cameroon, says she will receive about $5 when she completes and hands the bench to the refugee camp school that supplied the wood. Just by Naomi's carpentry workshop, Therese Mami works on a sewing machine. The Cameroonian also benefits from the United Nations training program, which has involved members of the host communities. Therese says she can now stitch torn dresses and be paid for her work. She says their trainers started by drawing types of dresses on the board for them to identify and also draw. And from there, they moved to various workshops where they were taught to stitch the items they were drawing. The skills training program is part of UNHCR's initiative to uphold the social and economic standing of refugees through education, vocational training, livelihoods promotion, and self-reliance initiatives. It encourages refugees and their hosts to interact to combat discrimination and reduce tensions and the scramble over already stretched natural resources. Mamadi Fata Kuruma, head of UNHCR in far northern Cameroon, says the training will also be useful to the refugees when they voluntarily accept to return to Nigeria.
La formation professionnelle pour nous, c'est donner la vie aux réfugiés.
He says to the UNHCR, training the refugees to be self-reliant is like giving them hope and making them independent and useful to themselves, their families, and communities. He says they expect the refugees, who are now professionals, to continue convincing and training others who are just idling around the camp so that they can be useful and not a burden when they return to their country. 60% of the Nigerians enrolled in the training are women. They say they will need financial assistance from the UN and the Nigerian government to be able to set up businesses when they return. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Minnawao, Northern Cameroon.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Mazima waise wakasela ngono mwana simula bana ko Mokugisa kumwana jali ngatange jendi wala Na musubiza mtinita Ela ne mutwala Na mpa uwe mtisebo Ndikulinda Ka
kabube yekuba kababe amayengo kabube obwavu kabibe bisibo ntya buli kaseera ndoota ngeri ya kutawanya nga nawe gyoli obirowoosako ono musajja maama alinda ndinatwala omanyira kulinda dda era nga nfayo akaseera kabadde kawamu nga manyi bakutwala maama omuwala muwanvu wanvu mulungi wakatake take anyirira akira balala omuwala muwanvu wanvu mulungi wakatake take anyirira akira balala saba nkikugambe kano kenzize kutwala amazima nsuubiza tikofunye nze kiwete sirimba kuba tugenda nakuba mu mirembe oli muwala mulungi osaana na birungi maama obeere bulungi bwekisana kwerengera maaso oliko luviiri lunzita lengera kaseko seka butyo omusana guyake we buliwo mwenya oleta emirembe mama omuwala muwanvu wanvu mulungi wakatake take anyirira akira
Kabichi, we mwagala ntibe,
Baby, sorry, utapata mwengine, don't you worry. mesa tuna woti yale tulipanga mina we mileli lakini nini 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 unanichanganya maisha wote wawili tulipanga shida ni nyingi hatuja kusana hainga kuwa hivyo unapenda upendi mpenzi tuachane na hivyo unaniumiza sana ninateseka nani moyoni mimi nauma
I got to go kangende
I need to go
sitaweza
nimevumilia sana utaki change na wana umeshindwa kubadilisha
I got to go kangupoe
I need to go
mkwano
unaniumiza mimi nauma
I got to go kangende
I need to go
sitawe
nimevumilia sana utaki change na wana umeshindwa kubadilisha
I got to go kangupoe
I need to go
mkwano
unaniumiza alipo haitweza beli atakula za mtu anakula zake zipo nipe changu na mimi nikupe chako kama unipendi hilo ni pako we got a lot of issues to say to pamoja twende mseto love me baby I will love you back scratch my back I will scratch your back not this way unapenda upendi unaniumiza sana ninateseka nani moyoni mimi na
kangende
anechiko
sitaweza
nimevumilia sana utaki change na wana umeshindwa kubadilisha
I got to go
kangupoe
anechiko
mkwano unaniumiza sana ninateseka nani moyoni mimi nauma
I got to go kangende
anechiko
sitaweza
nimevumilia sana utaki change na wana umeshindwa kubadilisha
I got to go kangupoe
missing of a tune and this one girl I'll never worry about it every time you come up on a sweet it this one funny man I'm here I'm music I'm
gonna need the sana nina the second and you want me me number
I got to go
can't end
I need to go
sit down
with me
Can't get time, it's a man's game.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The closely watched campaign in South Africa for the presidency of the African National Congress, ANC, ended in Johannesburg last week with the election of State Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa as the new president of the ANC. Despite the strong headwind of unfavorable media coverage, the election was a razor-thin victory for Cyril Ramaphosa. And when one takes into account the fact that two voting blocs were denied credentials and were said to be favorable to Dr. Zuma, it seems that the victory of Cyril Ramaphosa was not decisive. We should bear in mind the campaign of the two major contestants. Dr. Zuma, who is seen more of a diplomatic negotiator, campaigned on the need for radical economic transformation. On the other hand, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, who is strongly supported by the business community, campaigned on the need to fight against corruption in all aspects of the ANC. The moment it was known that he had won the election, the South African currency was strengthened by 2 or 3%. But one must also take into account that the balance of power is not too great in favor of Cyril Ramaphosa. For example, the conference took the decisions which were more in the direction of the loser, Dr. Zuma. The conference decided to pursue the policy of radical economic transformation. There were proposals to change the constitution of South Africa on the land issue to move away from the principles of willing buyer and willing seller. It is also important to take into account that the National Executive Committee of the ANC and the so-called Big Six members are equally balanced, taking into account the two factions within the ANC. So it is not likely that Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa will be in a position to drive policy within the ANC immediately. In fact, President Jacob Zuma will remain state president of South Africa until the end of 2018. There have been discussion in the South African media that it might be necessary to recall President Jacob Zuma in the course of 2018. However, in light of the fact that Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa is not so much in a strong position, and the fact that when Mr. Zuma, upon being appointed president of the ANC, moved to recall former President Mbeki, and that left a bitter feeling within the ANC, it is not likely that this may be the case. However, if during the course of 2018, President Zuma is dragged before the court on corruption charges, he himself might decide to bow down and allow the ANC to develop new policy and new president to conduct the elections in 2018 to give the ANC a chance to win. Finally, before the conference convened in Johannesburg last week, there were fears that the ANC will dissolve in disunity and split into two factions, because it was feared the losers will not accept any defeat. Fortunately, the conference concluded in unity, although the future is still precarious. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter and producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when your neighbor's horse falls into a pit, you should not rejoice at it, for your own child may fall into it too. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For the flood of migrants and refugees escaping the violence and poverty of several African countries and heading toward Europe for the opportunity of a better life, the most common route out of North Africa is through Libya. They present targets for people and criminal groups who prey on migrants. Their brutality knows no bound: sexual exploitation, forced labor, the removal of bodily organs, and slavery are the tools of their trade, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The migrant crisis in Libya received international attention once again following the recent report by CNN on African migrants being sold as slaves in unidentified locations across the country. Migrants were reportedly sold for as little as $200. Migrants who are smuggled can be extremely vulnerable to human trafficking, abuse, and other crimes, as they are illegally present in the country of destination or country of transit and often owe large debts to their smugglers. Some smuggled persons may be subjected to sex or labor trafficking while in transit or at their destination. The Libyan Government of National Accord, the GNA, launched an investigation into the allegations of trafficking in persons and pledged to hold perpetrators accountable. The United States strongly supports these efforts, and we view the GNA as a vital partner in combating human trafficking. The United States also continues to contribute to assistance programs that support the humanitarian needs of refugees, migrants, and individuals in detention in Libya. The United States works to combat human trafficking by focusing our efforts on the 3P paradigm of prosecution, protection, and prevention. We are funding research into the connection between conflict and vulnerability to human trafficking to help us understand how to better prevent this crime from happening in the first place. We hope to protect victims by immediately identifying them in conflict situations and assisting them, and we hold traffickers accountable by prosecuting them. We believe a victim-centered approach to investigation and prosecution of human trafficking is critical to overall success of law enforcement efforts. This includes commitments by states not to prosecute trafficking victims for acts committed as a direct result of being subjected to human trafficking, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Nikki Haley. We will continue to work with the UN Security Council and with partner governments to end this barbaric assault on human dignity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.